Chapter 2, A Culture of Democracy. We start from the basic notion that democracy is the people ruling. How do we make it happen in our unions? One thing is certain, you can't implement democracy simply by adopting a list of rules. Many unions use bylaws that look very democratic, but it doesn't take long for members to catch on that they hold little power. In other cases, despite using procedures that are essentially undemocratic, such as Robert's Rules of Order, the members know that it is their union. The culture of democracy is alive and well. How do we build such a culture? How do we build it in a world where people have so many different interests, skills, and competing demands on their time? In this chapter, we'll describe what a democratic union looks like. Be aware that we're proposing a level of democracy that doesn't much exist in this world, in unions or beyond. So the benchmarks here will be imperfectly met in even the best unions. So, benchmarks of union democracy. 1. The members look to the union for power in dealing with the employer, the community, other unions, politicians. 2. The members decide how the union deals with these forces. 3. The union is we, not they. 4. The issues facing the union and options for action are discussed openly. Mechanisms exist for issues to be voiced. Decisions are made openly in the forums established that for that purpose, such as executive board meetings or membership meetings. Expression of dissenting views and organizing to promote them are encouraged rather than punished. 5. Leaders and followers are strongly linked. Leaders act in the interest of members. Members easily organize themselves without waiting for marching orders. Members move easily into activist and leadership positions. Leaders encourage participation and help new leaders to develop, and there are many sources of leadership. The members trust the leaders, and the leaders trust the members. In other words, democracy is member power, participation, and a certain relationship between leaders and the ranks. Democracy is about power over the things that matter. Motions and votes and other procedures are valuable if they contribute to this bottom line. The primary place to check for these benchmarks is in the workplace. How are job issues, grievances, and contract terms handled? If the union is functioning democratically there, it will be easier to carry that culture into other areas such as union meetings and elections or other decisions such as how much money to budget for organizing. Make workplace culture a union culture. Union democracy at the workplace level means that unionism is part of what people do at work day in and day out. It needs to be taught in this individualistic society, but a union culture means that it becomes second nature for members to take a stand for solidarity when they see the need. For example, a member sees management abusing another worker and tells the manager that the union does not tolerate that kind of behavior. For example, a member sees a fellow worker engaging in sexual harassment and explains why it must stop immediately. For example, a member meets a non-union member worker and works to recruit her to the union. In other words, in this culture, solidarity is the norm and the expectation. Members don't feel they have to justify activities that contribute to solidarity. They would feel pressed to justify the exceptions. And members don't sit back and wait for a union rep to take care of problems. They take the initiative, whether it's on a grievance, on a problem not covered by the contract, or on organizing a response to a new management scheme or program. Leaders and activists can help develop a union culture on the job through simple organizing techniques. The most basic element is making the workplace the place where union issues are discussed. Since most union members seldom attend meetings, the broadest and often the most honest and imaginative discussions about union strategies happen informally at work, on breaks, or at lunch, or waiting for the copier, and I might add here, through text messaging. This book was written before text messaging existed, or cell phone calls. The union should not only defend members' right to express various points of view in the workplace, it should encourage the means. It should insist on members' right to distribute their own leaflets and to post any kind of union-related material they wish on accessible bulletin boards. One sign of an authoritarian atmosphere is a policy prohibiting workers from posting their own notices without management approval. Often, even union bulletin boards are under lock and allow only, quote, official, unquote, union publications initialed by an officer. Good discussion depends on good information. Is union literature circulated in the workplace rather than just mailed to members' homes? Are contracts, including all letters of understanding, made available? Do members have easy access to the status of all grievances in progress or recently decided? One of the most important sources of information is other unions dealing with similar circumstances or the same company. Are members encouraged to contact other locals on their own, or do officers make this as difficult as possible? Postal union says no addresses. This is a box under this section. Postal union says no addresses. Control of information, especially information that would allow members to be in direct contact with each other, is often seen as key to officials' grip on their positions. Rank-and-file delegates to the National Association of Letter Carriers 1996 convention proposed that it would seem a common-sense resolution to help local branches, local unions, learn from each other. Resolved that the national headquarters of the NALC publish annually a directory of all NALC branches. This directory shall consist of the mailing address of each branch. Branches may reserve the right to refuse publication for their branch address in said directory. The National Executive Board opposed the resolution, but it passed. Late in 1996, the National Office sent branches a notice requiring that they specifically notify the National Office if they wanted to be included in the directory. By the simple technique of changing the implementation from opting out to opting in, and depending on the tendency for projects that are not pushed to be buried, the national officers tried to sabotage the project. Even still, the final publication included addresses for nearly two-thirds of the NALC's 3,000 branches, and none for the NALC state associations. One key to making union culture central to the workplace is recognizing natural work groups. Every good organizer understands the idea of mapping the informal communication patterns in the workplace. Leaders can find out who the natural leaders are and make sure they are part of the union information system in both directions, getting information out and gathering feedback. Officers can show up at the workplace on a regular basis for informal but organized discussions with the members. In between, stewards should report what coworkers are saying about their concerns. Modern management techniques such as quality task forces and work teams lend urgency to the idea of making the workplace culture a union culture. Management designs these programs to generally strip members of their union identity and promote identification with the company team. Instead, they try to institute their own brand of workplace culture with champions, change agents, consensus, safety champions. Often the programs go under the guise of workplace democracy as management makes a point of gathering, quote, input, unquote, from workers. Participation programs include their own layer of facilitators or team leaders, a group of union members who are paid to help the program succeed. That is, their job is to promote the idea among coworkers that the company interests are their own. At the Saturn plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee, for instance, one of the best-known team concept programs, hundreds of members are appointed to help the program out of 7,200 total workers. The appointees work mostly straight day shifts while the rest of the plant works grueling alternating shifts. The appointees lose contact with life on the assembly line and have an investment in keeping the program going. It falls to the union or reformers within to champion real workplace democracy. Workers' best chance for any say over working conditions is a contract and members' initiative to enforce it on the shop floor. Meanwhile, they can do their best to besiege the teams with union culture and values. First, the union should organize open debate on the impact of the teams, both at the hall and on the shop floor, to replace the backbiting and resentment that so often poison relations among members. Second, the union should insist that positions such as team leader be elected so that any who become too enamored of the corporate line can be replaced. Third, unions should train members that they are representing the union, not simply their own individual ideas, whenever they meet with union, with management in task forces or teams. Members should make a habit of calling time out for a union caucus at these meetings and then deal with management in a united way. Thus, solutions to workplace problems get hashed out with other union members, not through brainstorming with the labor management quality team. Discuss real issues. The value of open debate ought to be non-controversial. It's the best way for a group of people to put their heads together to find the best possible solutions. In practice, lack of democracy begins with lack of real discussion. For instance, when officials don't involve members in winning a new contract, members don't help formulate demands or bargain strategy. And when they vote on ratification, they have to make a decision based on a pep talk without seeing the actual contract. That's why many successful union democracy efforts started as a rank-and-file organized contract campaign. Members wanted to discuss their contract concerns, and the leadership wasn't listening. The issues that affect work life most, work reorganization, rapid technological change, need to be discussed in the break rooms as well as the local meetings. If the ranks aren't involved in forming strategies on these questions, it doesn't matter how brilliant are the policies developed at the higher levels. Freedom of discussion is far more than the right to speak at a union meeting. If members with different points of view are intimidated or insulted, discussion doesn't get far. Attendees can tell whether questions and criticism are considered normal or offensive, and most people won't bother to raise concerns if it will annoy the gathered body. The columns of union newspapers contain many examples of official derision of opposing views. Another way to limit debate is by simply filling meeting time with boring reports. Or officers can informally squelch debate by making it clear that they deal with the real issues elsewhere, behind closed doors. Then speaking up at membership meetings or talking about union strategy over coffee break may be tolerated, but irrelevant. Again, few people will bother. Some top-down officers will allow debate as long as members speak as individuals, but not as an organized group. But the right to form a caucus or committee dedicated to some viewpoint is a key part of the right to express that viewpoint. At the 1996 SEIU convention, for example, a caucus of reform delegates brought several proposals, including one to eliminate multiple salaries for international officers. President Andy Stern allowed a limited debate on the multiple salaries proposal, but at the same time he told leaders of the Reform Caucus they could join his unopposed slate for International Executive Board only if they'd disbanded the caucus. They were not asked to stop speaking out as individuals on multiple salaries or other reform issues, just to stop organizing on this basis. Maintaining free discussion turns out to be difficult in practice. A harsh tone can cause hard feelings. It's often hard to get a room full of people to concentrate on the same issue at the same time. What some feel is an exercise of their right to free discussion may be seen by others as talking too long. Information on leading a good meeting is independence in Appendix 2 at the end of the book. Who is a leader? Union reformers hold divergent views of leadership. Some think their union will be healthy if they can just get a new set, the right set, of leaders. Others, after decades of experience with incompetent or corrupt officers, see the problem as the idea of leadership itself. In this view, the best way to democratize the union is to do away with leaders' power, or at least limit it with more checks and balances. We see leadership differently, as a needed tool in a complicated world. Leaders help us make sense of things we do not understand ourselves. Union leaders need a combination of knowledge and vision applied to the members' concerns. Good leaders have proposals to solve problems and the guts to see them through. A democratic union culture requires more leaders, not fewer. Stronger leaders, not weaker ones. Leadership is far more than just elected positions. You may look to your steward or your local union president, but many other people, publications, or institutions also help us understand the complex world. Some may look to the president or their senator or Oprah Winfrey, Jesse Jackson, or Rush Limbaugh for getting a handle on what is important. But leaders can also include the buddy who understands computers, the economics columnist in the newspaper, teachers, religious leaders, or the woman in the next department who seems to know how to handle the boss. These are all types of leaders possessing some combination of expertise, personal character, and a viewpoint close to our own. Most people serve as both leader and follower. The union president might look to one rank-and-file member as his leader on technology and another on city politics. The most important leader on health and safety questions in the local may be a steward. Someone may be the informal leader of her work group, as well as a loyal follower of the local president. In every workplace, there are informal groups, maybe people who hang out together on lunch breaks or bowl together after work, and these groups have their own leaders. Any strong union organization takes these informal leaders into account in distributing and collecting information, in mobilizing the members, in looking for new leaders for elected positions. People also move in and out of leadership, sometimes quickly, as when someone asserts himself on a particular issue at a meeting, sometimes over a long time. Most people are fully capable of increasing their leadership ability through work, study, or experience. The frequency with which members develop their expertise and use it to take on leadership roles is a sign of the health of a union democracy. Here's a box. What does a leader do? Teamster activist Joe Fahey asks a simple question to start a discussion about members taking leadership. He asks for people to throw out one or two word descriptions of things a good leader does. Here are some typical responses. Works, fights, guides, campaigns, clarifies issues, supports others, investigates issues, provides direction, reacts to events, negotiates, facilitates, takes heat, informs others, educates others, motivates others, brings together, promotes others, models behavior, cares, takes chances. A top-down decision may be best. Here's another example. In a surprise move in 1994, UPS changed its long-standing weight limitation for packages. Package sorters and drivers would now be required to lift 150 pounds, not just 70. In response, Teamsters president Ron Carey called on short notice a national strike to force the company to bargain the issue. In one day, UPS folded. Although many old guard local officers told their members not to strike, the action did force UPS to the table. Negotiations led to the right to get help from another Teamster to handle any package over 70 pounds. The decision to strike was made at the top of the union with no discussion or vote by the ranks. Was the decision democratic? By itself, the decision was neither democratic nor undemocratic. It was part of an increasingly democratic relationship between Teamster leaders and members. First, the strike could not have succeeded without widespread membership support. Indeed, in every local where the officers supported the strike call, the members overwhelmingly stood up to management's threats, often relayed by the old guard, and walked out. Teamster leaders had to be in close enough touch with the members to be confident they'd support the action in large numbers. Second, the top leaders knew that their members could and would hold leaders accountable for the results of the strike. There would be a national election soon with viable candidates in opposition. The decision involved risks. The contract had a no-strike clause. It was very possible that courts would rule the strike a contract violation. It was technically possible, though unlikely, that striking members could be fired. The union could possibly be sued for massive amounts of money. Given the possible severe consequences of defeat for the members and union treasury, shouldn't there have been a discussion in the union and a vote before action was taken? Indeed, if there had been an initial poll, chances are that many, perhaps even most members, would have opposed walking out. A good portion of the membership was still cynical about the union and unionism. Old guard officials would have campaigned hard against taking any action. So a strike vote might not have passed. There are good reasons to have waged an internal campaign prior to any taking action. A more united membership, clear on the issues and strategy, would have been better to stand up to the to management's threats. On the other hand, there were good reasons to act immediately. UPS was vulnerable because it did not have plans, resources in place for a massive strike. A long internal preparation period would guarantee that UPS would also prepare, and an important union advantage would be lost. A sudden policy change made the issue clear and hot now. Waiting would mean that UPS would be able to carry out its oft-used divide-and-conquer strategy. The policy would be implemented differently at different station centers, and it would be harder to establish an obvious point to take action. Finally, the company policy was a direct threat to worker safety. The union needed a strong and immediate response. Teamster leaders had to weigh all the pros and cons of immediate action versus a campaign to involve the members in making strategy. This single top-down decision couldn't by itself destroy a democratic relationship between leaders and members. In fact, a top-down decision could even bolster democracy. For instance, it's logical to think that the union may have been strengthened in two ways. For one, UPS members, including those who did not strike, got the message that more militance against the company is possible and useful. Second, the old guard's ability to scare some members out of striking may have reinforced for international leaders the need to have the ranks solidly on board before a major action. But before the 1997 UPS contract deadline, top Teamster officials certainly did work hard to make this unity happen. Here's another box. How far out front should leaders be? We need for union leaders to point the direction and step out front, not just carry out members' instructions. At the same time, we require leaders to listen to members about strategy and direction, and often, in fact, to carry out members' instructions. For democracy, leaders must strike a balance between leading the way based on their own knowledge and vision and taking direction from members. It's not always easy to know how to do that. Consider, for example, the Service Employees International Union's Committee on the Future. John Sweeney, as SEIU president, convened this committee in 1992 to study the union situation and make recommendations for its future course. The group of local and international officials conducted surveys, held meetings at 70 work sites, consulted with outside experts over a four-year period. The committee published a refreshingly honest report on their findings in early 1996. Of course, Sweeney and other SEIU leaders already knew what they thought the union needed. Sweeney had been talking for years about the need for more organizing, a theme he carried into the AFL-CIO leadership. The Committee on the Future found, however, that members distrusted new organizing as a solution to their problems at work. The union already did not seem effective on the job, so members were uneasy about removing resources from servicing. As Sweeney's successor, Andy Stern, took the union's helm in 1996, the Committee on the Future recommended and the convention adopted a new program to shift resources into organizing, even though the members had said that was not what they wanted. Was Andy Stern and the SEIU leadership stepping out front appropriately on a program that many believe is vital to the nation's survival? Or to the union's survival? Or was SEIU leadership confident in their superior analysis, ignoring the members' right to make decisions on the future of their own union? Judging by the late relationship between SEIU leaders and the ranks, we would say both are true. The need for new organizing is clear and immediate. Leaders should take the lead in showing how it can be done. But in SEIU, alternative leadership is not encouraged to articulate a different vision for the future. And at the same 1996 convention that adopted the Committee for the Future report, a group of local officers had been organizing for more democracy was dismantled through a combination of threats and rewards. Alternate leadership and vision were removed. Did the Committee on the Future process help involve members in their union by giving them a feeling of control? More likely for those that participated by completing a survey or speaking to the committee, the outcome seemed like a foregone conclusion and their participation was of little use. Was the committee's research on members' views part of an ongoing exchange of views between leaders and members? In the SEIU, like most large unions, communication between the members and leaders at any level is weak, composed mostly of newsletters composed by staff and occasionally votes taken among the members. That was one reason the Committee on the Future series of meetings with members was remarkable. It was an exception. Now that the program has been adopted, do the ranks have a reasonable chance to judge its effectiveness and adjust the policies later, or elect new international leaders who will? The SEIU's convention system and culture of top-down leadership and staff control make it nearly impossible in the foreseeable future. Has the SEIU leadership built up trust among the members by acting democratically on members' concerns over the years? Such trust earned over time allows leaders to step farther out front and still have members follow. But one of the Committee on the Future's findings was that members want more voice on the job and in their union, a sign that their trust of leaders is not strong. The SEIU leadership did give a nod to members' desire for democracy by including expanding members' voice among their stated goals. The International Magazine has occasionally, since 1996, highlighted locals that are training members to take over more of their grievance handling. Since the new organizing program cannot succeed without members' approval, that is, volunteering their time as organizers, members do have some control, but without an ongoing debate over the strategy, SEIU risks that members will continue to feel the leadership's program has little to do with them. Leaders should lead. Union leaders are not just a statistical sample of the membership. Since they are more active in the union than the average member, they are likely to be more knowledgeable about issues facing the union and to spend more time thinking about strategies. These differences mean that leaders have different points of view from the members on many questions. Here we're not talking about the leader who is out of touch because she's adopted a management point of view or lifestyle, but the good leader who's more experienced and a chance for a broader view than most of the rank and file. What should be the relationship between what leaders do and the positions held by the members? Is not leadership simply to announce the results of a membership opinion poll or to do the political equivalent? For members to have real alternatives, leaders must actually lead. They must step out front to argue for what they believe is the best plan of action, even if the members do not currently agree. Those who disagree should step forward and offer a different plan. When leaders step out front in a democratic union, it works because there's a feedback loop, a chance for members to reverse policies and/or throw out leaders who have led in the wrong direction. In a democratic culture, good leaders will, whenever possible, seek to win over the membership before committing the union and its resources externally. It will put forward its program boldly and clearly and rely on discussion, opposition, education programs, resolutions, and internal campaigns to achieve membership support. The process of debate helps refine and improve the plan. Further, as we argue in Chapter 1, the union's power to implement the plan depends in large part on the membership having a clear understanding and a strong commitment to it. Results that don't come from sneaking something through or keeping it only among the top leaders. To prepare for the 1997 UPS strike, for example, the Teamsters International waged a contract campaign so that members would be on the program to make the strike and related job actions as effective as possible. Another example can be seen in the support that the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union gave to the formation of the Labor Party. For many years, a few leaders of OCAW believed that the formation of a Labor Party was essential if the labor movement was ever to break out of its dependent relationship to corporate politicians. There was no spontaneous demand for a Labor Party from the OCAW members, who were probably not much different from other unionists on political views. As a relatively democratic union, the leadership understood that putting big resources into the Labor Party required winning over the members, and they did. Not every member, of course, but for many others, their support is minimal and passive. But a significant number of OCAW secondary leaders became Labor Party activists, and the convention regularly voted continued support for the project. It's not always possible for leaders to take a discussion to the membership before acting, as the top-down decision discussed earlier. Decisions here become a real test of leadership. Circumstances may require that union leaders step out and commit themselves and the union on an issue that may not yet have full support among the members. Yet waiting can also have enormous consequences. No action is also an action. It's one of the jobs of leaders, one of the reasons we elected them, to make these kinds of judgments and to have sufficient knowledge of and confidence in the members to expect that they will likely agree with the action once it is explained. In a democratic situation, a leader also takes the consequences if she misjudges. Linking members and leaders. In a healthy relationship between leaders and members, there's a flow of people, information, and influence back and forth. Leaders need active members, and that gives members some control over leaders. Conscientious leaders need the consent of the governed. They can't lead well if members don't agree to follow, that is, to participate in the union's affairs. Although some officers think they can or must handle everything themselves, management usually knows whether leaders have anyone behind them. Because leaders need followers to accomplish anything, they have to respond, at least to some degree, to what members want. Of course, many union leaders don't want to accomplish anything beyond a better golf game. This doesn't apply to them. This consent of the governed connection between leaders and ranks is very clear in the organizing phase of a union. In-plant leaders have to work very hard to respond to potential members' interests and thereby convince them to join. The net result is a highly democratic atmosphere, even if security considerations limit the usual democratic procedures, such as election of officers or votes on policy. A similar situation exists in right-to-work states, where belonging to a union is voluntary. Leaders who want to maintain membership numbers have to pay constant attention to recruiting new members and retaining current ones, thus stay in good touch with what workers want. Some believe this situation contributes to more active membership and healthier internal life than in unions that require workers to join. Nonetheless, an open shop is not a good way to strengthen members' control over leaders. An active membership doesn't count for much if too few of the workers in the bargaining unit sign up. Quitting the union may be an immediate tool for showing displeasure with the leaders, but using that tool weakens the union. And in an open shop, the boss can count on certain workers to scab and can mark the union members for retribution. If we measure democracy in terms of members' power to use the union against the boss, an open shop isn't a very democratic situation. Members have the most control over leaders when they're in a struggle with management. If they want a good contract, leaders need members to come out to rallies, picket, carry on an in-plant campaign, and all these are voluntary acts that members aren't likely to take on if they don't think their leaders are acting in their interests. That's why so many contract campaigns start out with surveys to determine members' priorities. There's a box here. Does dues checkoff harm democracy? Before unions got employers to deduct dues from paychecks, the checkoff system, they had to work hard for the money. In industrial unions, dues collection was one of the main jobs of the shop steward. Unions that wanted a healthy treasury made sure that the steward was someone strong and respected by the people in her department. This meant, in turn, that the higher levels of union leadership had to respond to stewards. If members were unhappy, it would be harder to collect dues, and leaders would hear about it in two powerful ways. The treasury would go down, and the stewards would be giving them an earful. There's no question that the introduction of dues checkoff happened right alongside the rapid destruction of the shop floor steward system in major production industries in the late 1940s and early 50s. But it's debatable what caused what. Some argue that the bedrock of the steward system, and indeed of democracy in the union, was dues collection, was the dues collection arrangement. Given the current bureaucratization of the labor movement, we better take this point seriously. The loss of the steward system was probably the biggest single marker of the rise of business unionism. But before we demand that unions give up dues checkoff, consider the alternative arguments. If shop floor leaders spend a big chunk of their time collecting and keeping track of dues, where's the time to organize the members, challenge the boss, do solidarity work with other unions, or organize the unorganized? 2, doesn't the regular and dispersed handling of so much cash open the way for corruption, fronting for gambling, and mob activity? The numbers bracket also depends on regular collections, but no one confuses it with a democratic organization. 3, wouldn't using dues collection to make the union responsive make it responsive mainly to the people who are least committed to the union? After all, solid union members will always pay quickly. The dues collector mainly has to spend time cajoling the people who are not certain the union is worth it. 4, should the main qualification for steward be the person who can best collect dues? 5, doesn't this system hurt the union at the time it is most vulnerable? Tough times when there are high unemployment, layoffs are likely, and people are most inclined to save a little extra by skipping union dues is just the time the union does not need to be hurting financially or dealing even more with dues collection problems. In fact, employers sometimes cut off dues checkoff at strategic times to weaken union resistance. As the HMO Kaiser Permanente did during a 16-month contract battle with the California Nurses Association in 1997-98. CNA reports that 80% of its Kaiser members paid dues anyway. 6, doesn't the very idea that people should choose to be in or out of the union on a monthly basis, depending on how they feel that the union is doing, encourage the individualist and consumerist approach that underlies the service model of unionism? On this model, people could decide whether to pay dues or based on whether they personally received services they felt were worth the money. 7, was it really dues checkoff that caused destruction of the steward system, or were these two parts of a deal? The general labor business accord that increased management and control over the shop floor, weakening stewards in exchange for providing some institutional security for the unions, reliable dues collection. Membership input should be based on good information. We cannot expect leaders to act in members' interests unless they know what members need and want, and members can't make good decisions without good information. Elections and surveys gather input, but they're only snapshots at particular moments. They tend to provide limited choices, and they often direct only the most intense and widespread views. Detect only the most intense and widespread views. The more immediate forms of feedback are required. Discussions at meetings, letters, columns and newsletters, open door policies at union offices, email and message centers, meetings with intermediate level leaders, workplace walkarounds, working leadership, and social activities. Officers who spend time on the job site, not just down at the union hall, have a big advantage. To get good input, leaders must provide good output through union publications, regular meetings, and formal and informal networks. Telephone trees, websites, and email are important for fast-moving events. Here's an example of bad information. Because they think the members are not smart enough or can't be trusted with the truth, leaders publish a summary of a proposed contract with only the good points highlighted. Leaders may believe that proclaiming every contract a victory will be better for morale in the long run, or they do it to save their own jobs. But members usually see through such declarations. Calling a defeat a victory simply cuts off discussion and the chance to learn from experience why the defeat happened and how to keep it from happening again. Ironically, open discussion could actually help officials stay in office by making it clear that it was company power, not leadership incompetence, that caused the loss. Moving into leadership should be fairly easy. A healthy union strives to expand and replenish leadership. It rejects the notion that training new leaders means you're training your own opposition. When new leaders move into activity, they bring the members' most current concerns. The union can make becoming a leader as easy and attractive as possible with a mentoring system and a committee structure that is open for participation. The union should encourage college labor studies courses. Members can learn a lot more about being a leader through action groups like Jobs with Justice or the Labor Party. In a democratic union, members have the chance to change their leaders. Even if they don't contest every election, there are always alternatives, people with skills and confidence who can voice competing views. Opposition caucuses are the most important sources of alternative leaders, and successful caucus leaders can consciously train members in the same skills a good union leader needs. Does leadership power always corrupt? In unions and politics, and indeed from athletic clubs to PTAs, there are plenty of examples of leaders who betray those who elected them by serving themselves at the expense of their members. Some social scientists say that leadership in any kind of organization leads directly to betrayal. Power corrupts, the saying goes, yet we cannot imagine a society without organization and leaders. Put these facts together, and we are doomed to betrayal every time. The belief that betrayal is inevitable breeds massive cynicism and apathy, but it's not true. There is abundant writing on the pressures that separate leaders from followers and tend to lead to betrayal. The phrase, the iron law of oligarchy, comes from a classic work by Robert Michaels, who observed developments in the German Social Democratic Party, the mass political party of the German unions prior to World War I. Michaels argued that initial leaders act to aid the movement, but soon, says Michaels, leaders tend to become professionals. The organization's structure becomes an end unto itself and not a tool for the members. Leaders become entrenched and manipulative, manipulate the organization into serving their own special interests. Modern unions would seem to confirm the iron law. First, full-time officials have many reasons to hang on to their positions. Typically, their income is significantly higher than members. The working conditions are usually better, too. The jobs are more flexible. The work is clean, safe, and not physically exhausting. Charles Hughes, president of an AFSCME local representing school crossing guards and cafeteria workers who make $10,000 to $15,000 a year, makes $241,000 himself, said, I think it's justified, said Hughes. The members of my local have the best fringe benefits for part-time people in the United States of America. Even when the income difference is not so great, leaders develop a strong interest in protecting their jobs from potential rivals. Second, organization provides officials with ways to maintain their privileges, control of patronage jobs, the distribution of paid time off the job for union activity and grievance handling are potential ways to reward friends and punish enemies. The officials' control of communications, newsletters, and steward networks also tends to protect their status. Third, plenty of examples seem to confirm Michael's description of the membership as passive and tending to rely too much on leaders. Nevertheless, Michael's iron law is wrong. The main problem with this iron law is that it confuses forces with outcomes. Yes, there will always be forces that tend to cause leaders to go bad, but such forces are not irresistible. Let's look at the Teamsters again for an example. The membership elected a reform team of officers in 1991 that vastly improved communications, kept member input, weeded out many of the worst officials, and even won a major strike against UPS. Then a fundraising scandal was uncovered inside reform leader Ron Carey's 1996 reelection campaign. Wasn't that proof that no matter the progress, corruption is inevitable? Many disgusted rank-and-filers voiced the sentiment, they're all alike. Reform suffered a major setback, but the problem was not inevitable. Kerry relied on unscrupulous consultants for much of his 1996 campaign, and they hatched the illegal fundraising scheme. If TDU had been bigger, if reform forces had been stronger, they would have been much more the core of the Kerry campaign. Corrupt consultants will never have had such influence in the campaign or the union. What's more, even with this setback, which led to a chance for the old guard to reassert itself, the culture of the Teamsters had changed. No future Teamster International official, reformer or old guard, will dare to bargain major contracts in secret, as was the practice until 1992, nor impose contracts voted down by the majority, as happened several times in the 1980s. Teamsters have come to expect a higher level of democracy, and TDU remains active to give voice to that expectation. The net result of the reforms is positive and long-lasting. In fact, as much as we can cite evidence for the inevitable forces of the bureaucratization or corruption, time and again, new struggles and new organizations arise to fight for the original union goals. People want decent lives, and that requires continued effort. If TDU didn't exist today, Teamsters would be forming it, just as members of other unions are starting reform groups every year. The Iron Law is not neutral theory. It masquerades as objective academic science, telling us that some form of dictatorship is inevitable and that we are powerless to do anything about it. But as such, the law becomes a powerful weapon for those who want to keep people cynical and disorganized, the very conditions required for a dictator to rule. When people give up on struggle and accept the Iron Law, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If dictatorship is inevitable, then you might as well pick the dictator you like best. Michael's own logic led him to be an ardent supporter of Mussolini and Italian fascism. And there's a box here on socialists in the labor movement. Historically, in the U.S. as well as the rest of the world, socialists have been important sources of union leadership and alternative leaders. But in recent decades, their radical views have been seen as dangerous, and almost anyone who challenges union officials with a more militant outlook could expect to be called a red. Socialists, with their vision of a new society that included strong trade unions, developed union leaders who were frequently both self-sacrificing and knowledgeable. They provided the activist cadre for difficult union struggles and were a strong counter to those who viewed union leadership as the ladder to personal gain. Their long-term vision helped carry unions through difficult periods. In one sense, socialist thought is the ideology of unionism carried to its logical conclusion. If workers should have more power and control in the workplace, why shouldn't they have full power and control in society as a whole? The history of such groups reveals a mixed impact on the labor movement in the United States, some bad but mostly good. Despite their role in the formation of the labor movement, however, McCarthyism and red baiting caused socialists to be written out of much of labor history. In the height of the red baiting of the 1950s, UEW President Walter Reuther explained how damaging this was to the cause of labor. Quote, "Many years ago in this country, when the bosses wanted to keep the workers from forming a strong union, they tried starting scares of various kinds. One scare the bosses raised was the Catholics against the Protestants. Another scare they used very successfully was the American-born against the foreign-born. Then they placed one foreign group against another, like the Poles against the Germans, and so on. All that is played out now. It has been worked too often. So now the bosses are trying a new stunt. They're raising a new scare, the Red Scare. They pay stools to go whispering around that so-and-so, usually a militant union leader, is a Red. They think that will turn the other workers against them. What the bosses really mean, however, is not that he's really red. They mean they do not like him because he's a loyal, dependable union man, a fighter who helps his brothers and sisters and is not afraid of the boss. So let's all be careful that we don't play the boss's game by falling for the Red Scare. Let's stand by our union and fellow unionists. No union man worthy of the name will play the boss's game. Some may do so through ignorance, but those who peddle the Red Scare and know what they're doing are dangerous enemies of the union." that Reuther's actions were not always consistent with those sentiments did not make the principles any less true. Of course, this book was written at the time of the... it was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Interesting. Okay. So, guidelines for rules and procedures in a democratic culture. A dictatorship requires only one rule. Whatever the boss wants, whatever the boss wants. A democratic union seeks to involve as many members as possible in decision making, so it needs many more rules and procedures for how it should happen fairly. This should happen fairly. Of course, rules and procedures are just the connecting devices between the essential elements of democratic culture, membership information and involvement, real power, and healthy give and take between leaders and members. Rank and file organizing is the key to building these elements. Look at two unions that were both pressured by the Justice Department to change their election procedures, the Teamsters and the Laborers. Both held rank and file monitored elections for international officers. In the Teamsters, the constitutional changes would not have mattered much if it weren't for the work done by TDU before and after the election. TDU provided what new rules could not: a coordinated movement to define issues, train rank and file leaders, back up campaigners on their rights. Without this organization, no reformer could have won the first direct election in the Teamsters in 1991. And if a reformer had won without this network of rank and file activists, he could not have led the union, most of whose 600 locals were still governed by supporters of the old guard. In the Laborers, no strong rank and file organization existed. Incumbents were reelected and little changed. C box. Okay, what's the box say? Rank and file organization makes the difference. In 1996, the Laborers Union held its first ever direct election for international president and secretary treasurer. Only about 15% of the members voted, compared to around 30% turnout in the Teamsters. Some of the observers say the low turnout reflected the lack of real choice in this historically corrupt union. Incumbent president Arthur Coia, reputed to be an associate of a New England crime family, was challenged by Bruno Caruso, himself believed to have ties with the Chicago mob. One activist said it looked at the members like the organized crime version of Family Feud. Coia won, but by about 2-1. Those voting did choose, by about 78%, to change the Constitution. Starting in 2001, all international officers, not just the top two, are to be directly elected by the members. But without an organized reform network, these future elections are likely to replay the 1996 contest. The federal government also took action against the hotel employees and restaurant employees, an international with a similar long history of apparent corruption. Under an agreement with the Justice Department, HERE had an independent monitor for 30 months in 95 to 98, but no new elections. Federal investigators quietly pushed several officials to resign, and a new, clean president took over. But there was no established reform group strong enough to take advantage of these minimal changes, and monitorship did not alter the union's shop floor culture. When evaluating the union's rules, remember that different circumstances call for different procedures. Democracy takes many forms. Holding a debate on a political endorsement in the middle of a strike, for example, may undermine the union's power by diverting energy from the immediate crisis. Or it may strengthen that power if the politician, once elected, plays a hand in the strike. During the early phases of organizing a union, for example, the emphasis may be on practices that make the union as open as possible to new people, holding small informal meetings by work group, for instance. As the union develops, more emphasis is needed on developing leaders. Larger, more structured meetings might be organized, with several members giving reports and leading discussions. Or consider a large workplace, like a factory, where most members are in one or two big job classifications. Should each of these smaller classifications, skilled trades, clerical, professional, janitors, have their own bargaining representative? If so, the ratio of representation for the small groups will be much higher than for the large classifications. Perhaps instead the rule should be one bargaining per bargainer per certain number of members. The answer will depend on the unit's history and situation. Are the concerns of the smaller classifications sufficiently addressed under the second scheme? Have the higher skilled classifications traditionally had more voice in the union than their numbers warrant? The key question is which procedure will increase member involvement and the power of the union. Either falls within the realm of democracy. The point is not to get hung up on procedures and bylaws if the members and the leaders are in touch and the union is strong. That said, although procedures are neither the substance of democracy nor the route to achieving it, they are important tools. They can either reinforce democratic values or get in the way of members' power. We offer here some guidelines for evaluating union procedures and how they contribute to democratic culture. 1. Members must have the right to organize for a viewpoint. Organizations within the union are critical for its democracy. Caucuses, slates, or networks are ways for members to hold leadership accountable. Few union constitutions provide for or mention union caucuses, yet it is ability to easily form such organizations that is the most important pressure for democracy within the union. The right to speak your mind is not worth much if you don't also have the right to organize for your point of view. Therefore, the right to join and promote a caucus without retribution is a priority. A union does not have to have an opposition caucus in order to be democratic, but in a democratic union, members can easily form caucuses, if only temporarily, around some issue, such as a rank-and-file pension improvement committee. 2. Members must have the right ability and self-confidence to act on their own behalf. Members should have the right to initiate and write their own grievances, to form a committee to go to the boss about it. If a violation is not even recognized until an officer happens to see it and nothing is done unless an official takes a formal action, the union is weak. An active membership demands more of its leaders and therefore pushes them to a higher level of performance. 3. Members must have ways to hold leaders accountable. Ultimately, the election process is the main accountability mechanism. Between elections, the pressure on officers to appear democratic is still great, if only because too many clearly undemocratic actions will be remembered at election time. So a large group of members speaking out at a meeting or circulating petitions and distributing flyers will often inspire officials to reassess their actions. These informal mechanisms require the right to organize mentioned above. A healthy union will also have mechanisms for accountability that can deal formally with smaller issues that do not require waiting for the next election. The ability of the membership meeting to reverse or direct an action by the officers is an example of such a mechanism. The right of members to initiate a bylaws change is another. 4. The union needs to protect both majority rule and minority rights. Majority rule, that key to democracy, only works when the minority can organize for its point of view. For one thing, members have the power to decide only if they have options to choose from. It's the minority of today, seeking to become the majority of tomorrow, that provides the democratic option to all members. Second, when the majority respects the right of the minority has every reason to support the organization as a whole, supporting a strike they voted against, for example. If, on the other hand, minorities feel excluded, they have little incentive to act in solidarity with the majority's choice. Minority rights are essential to maintain the unity that gives the union, and therefore the majority, its strength. The rights of minorities can be a thorny question for reformers who have won office over an old guard that then becomes a well-organized minority. See Chapter 6 for more on dealing with political opponents when in office. Finally, it's especially important to respect the concerns of racial and gender minorities. Management can easily see and exploit such divisions, and the danger to unity is great. 5. Procedures should help to level the playing field. Democracy works best on a level playing field where everyone has equal resources and equal opportunity. But our society is no level playing field. Every union member brings different resources, experiences, and skills to the organization. Therefore, union procedures should be evaluated for whether they level the playing field or increase the tilt. For instance, a group of registered nurses may tend to dominate a union they share non-professional nurse aides, should the aides have a minimum number of seats on the board. In elections, incumbents generally have the advantage over challengers. How can challengers get a leg up? We will sort out some of these issues in Chapter 5. The sharpest divisions in the workplace are typically based on race and gender job stratification, along with age, sexual orientation, and physical disabilities. While some unions have distinguished themselves in the fight for equality, others have a sad history of racial and other discrimination, one of the commonest crimes against democracy. The results of this history are to tilt the playing field inside the union in favor of white people and men, to ignore this history and insist on race-blind or gender-blind rules means that the playing field stays tipped. Unionists need to back affirmative action in hiring and promotion to get past obstacles to fairness in our own organization. Each section of the membership may have a different agenda of strongly felt needs, which then must be combined into a union agenda. To make this happen, all sections of the union need to be brought into the leadership. We consider this issue in Chapter 3. 6. The rules must be clear and simple. Think of the many members who have come to a union meeting because there's an issue they want to deal with, but then can't get through the complex rules on motions and points of order. Will they ever come back? Properly used, rules make it easier for members, especially new ones, to get involved. The rules can make everyone know how things are supposed to work. For example, having a simple rule on how to introduce a motion means that a member with a concern is encouraged to bring it up. The best constitutions, bylaws, and rules are brief, clear, and uncomplicated. TDU is a lively democratic group whose members vie for leadership positions within it, and its constitution fits on a sheet of legal paper. Examine almost any undemocratic organization, and it's likely to have very complicated formal rules, and in practice abide by them only when they are useful to the leadership. A clear set of rules reveals how decision-making works in the union. What can the staff or board decide, and what could membership meetings determine? If the union meeting is the highest authority, it should be clear how to bring questions there that are appropriate to that authority. 7. Surprise and secrecy are enemies of democracy. Without the opportunity to gather information, talk to others, and organize a response, the right to vote has little meaning. Yet in many unions, the membership meeting announcements posted at work list the agenda as old business and new business. How does that help members know what issues are up for discussion? Or in the name of preventing rumors, leaders do not give members advance copies of the contract before the ratification meeting. One of the most insidious aspects of labor management cooperation programs is the requirement of confidentiality. Although one of the most touted benefits of such programs is access to corporate information, access is limited to team members on a project who are not allowed to discuss the information with union sisters and brothers. Unions should refuse participation in any activity with management that requires advance agreement to confidentiality. Sometimes officers justify the usual secrecy around bargaining in the name of not showing your hand to management. But the bargainers are certainly revealing their demands to management. That's what bargaining is. The only ones not showing the demands are the members. Leaders who rely on secrecy keep little from the employer, but do build a huge barrier between themselves and the rank and file. More commonly, the secrecy around bargaining is acquiescence to the company's request to not, quote, bargain in the press, unquote. Many unions, though, have found that the more members know about management's stand through frequent bulletins, reports, and rank-and-file observers, the easier it is to mobilize support for bargainers. Tactical surprise may give the union an advantage vis-a-vis an employer. One tactic of the Detroit newspaper strike, for example, was surprise pickets and sit-ins against secret targets. But the advantage of surprise has to be weighed against the cost to democracy, as well as the difficulty of keeping a secret among large numbers of people. Do union leaders have such a record of accountability that the members trust them for a few secret decisions? If not, a non-sneak attack may inspire more long-term membership involvement. 8. Look for the long-term results. We shouldn't let a short-term gain disguise a long-term loss, as when management proposes a long-term gain for the company, holding wages down, in exchange for a short-term gain for us, a bonus. The same sort of trap can occur with union procedures. Paying lost time for union activities may boost membership participation initially, but over time, members may refuse to participate unless they're paid. A disaster for democracy. Or a discussion of goals may seem like a waste of time at the outset of a contract campaign if most members already agree on priorities, but holding such a discussion might have a big effect on members' involvement over the course of the struggle. The culture of a reform movement. A caucus within a union and the union itself are two quite different animals. You shouldn't want your reform caucus to mimic the structure and procedures of a union, but a democratic culture is indeed needed in a reform caucus. One common pitfall of new organizations, including new reform caucuses in unions, is to overstructure a small group. To immediately formulate long bylaws and reporting procedures, elect 6 officers and 4 standing committees. Is all that really helpful? An elected steering committee and simple financial reports may be plenty of organizational structure. The caucus's culture is more important. For one thing, modeling a democratic culture within the caucus helps people to learn how that can work, how members taking initiative can generate creative strategies, how active inclusion of racial or gender minorities can strengthen the whole group, how encouraging new leadership can also encourage new activism. Second, a caucus depends as much on member involvement as the union does, maybe more, since dues payments are totally voluntary. So to organize a caucus, its leaders have to be in close touch with members and potential members to be sure the caucus is taking on problems that people think are important and fixable. The same interchange between leaders and members that we discussed for unions has to happen within a caucus. To stay relevant and avoid burnout, a caucus needs to be continually bringing new leaders. Bringing new leaders along can be harder than it sounds. It requires asking a lot of different people to volunteer in a lot of different ways. The difficulty is not just that sometimes volunteers don't get their assignments done, which can be upsetting for the committed caucus leader who asks them to help. So often it's just easier to do the work yourself. Coordinating a newsletter committee is a lot more time-consuming than simply sitting down and typing it out. Caucus leaders, like union leaders, should be very careful about how much they put getting work done ahead of getting new people involved in doing it. The main reason, of course, for building a democratic culture in your reform caucus, as in the union, is to make it more effective. And there's a box. How does TDU set national policy and strategy? Formally, TDU is governed by annual conventions open to all members. The conventions elect an international steering committee, which meets 5 times a year to guard the organization between conventions. But that's only part of the story. These bodies are not guaranteed to represent the views of most TDU members. In general, they do, and that's by conscious effort. TDU lives or dies by its ability to voice the concerns of most of its members and supporters to act democratically. The organization's leaders are able to do that through frequent informal communication with and among activists in local TDU chapters. The most common kind of question a TDU national leader asks a local organizer is, what are people saying about blank? The activists who can answer that are the best recruiters, in closest touch with other Teamsters, and the most influential in the national organization. They are also the most successful in building a local reform caucus. Local activists distribute TDU information and bulletins, talk up the issues among members, hear what they think, and communicate responses and new concerns back to the national leaders. Based on this local organizing, they have ideas for national strategy. And that concludes chapter 2.